All right, you're listening to Green Left Radio. And for our first guest on the program, we're very happy to have Ian Ellis-Jones on our program today. He is a member of Social Science who is currently based in Sydney, and he has been a regular kind of commentator of late for Green Left on Cuba. And Cuba is a country we actually haven't covered significantly in a while. So we're having Ian on to have a bit of a kind of discussion about some of the current kind of developments that are happening in Cuba, especially the development of the COVID vaccine, their current relationship with the United States, who has still imposed a kind of trade embargo, and also maybe a sort of a bit of a summary of, you know, politics in Cuba, some of the kind of recent kind of developments. And so, yeah, good morning, Ian.
Good morning, Jacob. Thank you for having me on the program.
Yeah. So, Ian, maybe to kind of start off, maybe just for our kind of listeners, what can you tell us about, you know, some of the current sort of developments that have happened in Cuba lately, as well as, I guess, a summary, I guess, of where the country is currently at in terms of, yeah, its politics and so on?
Yes. Well, the major issue facing Cuba at the moment, like so many other countries, is COVID-19. Cuba was doing extremely well throughout all of last year. They had a number of advantages, a centralized health system and free universal health care. And would you believe the world's highest ratio of doctors to population? And there were a lot of other good indicators that helped Cuba deal with COVID throughout last year, high life expectancy and low infant mortality, which the rate of infant mortality over there is lower than the United States. So that's something to ponder on. Late last year, they started opening up the country again to tourism. And I'll talk about the obvious economic effects of not having tourists throughout most of last year. But when they opened up and developments in COVID itself, variants coming along, the Brazil variant, and more recently the Delta one, they've really smashed hard. And at the moment in Cuba, they're looking at round about 2,000 new cases a day. Overall, since COVID started, they've had about 203,000 cases, about 1,200 mortalities. But at the moment, you're running at about 2,000 cases a day, and that's proving quite difficult. It's had enormous economic effect, of course, because tourism is their major industry and has been for some time. Most of their tourists come from Canada. A few from the United States, not as many as before, quite a few from Europe, even some from Australia, including my own family. But yeah, tourism has been hit hard, and so the economy has been hit hard. In terms of COVID, though, there's been a number of interesting developments. For a number of years now, and you mentioned the embargo, and we can talk about that later, the longest running embargo in the world in modern times. It's quite obscene, the effects that it's had on the Cuban people and the Cuban economy. And it's been totally ineffective. It hasn't achieved its objective of regime change. But Cuba produces about 80% of its own vaccine, all types of inoculations. And in terms of COVID-19, last year they developed four separate vaccines, three of them injectable. Soberano 1, Soberano 2, Abdala, and then there's a vaccine which is developed, which is used by way of a nasal spray called Mambisa. Now, in March this year, they fully vaccinated all healthcare workers, and mid-May, they started inoculating the general population. They don't have a great problem over there with anti-vaxxers. There's a lot of faith in the medical system, their doctors. And so getting people to come up and be vaccinated is not a big issue over there. Mm-hmm. At the moment, they're looking at, it's got about, of a population of 11.3 million people, about 2.2 million have already been vaccinated. Of those, I think 1.7 million have had their first dose, and 1.7 have had their second dose, and 900,000 their third dose. They're mainly using a dose that they've developed themselves, Abdala, which is named after a character in a famous poem of that name by Jose Marti, who was a great war hero over there and patriot. dead now, but if there is a patron saint of Cuba, it's Jose Marti. Well, Abdallah was a character in this poem that stood up to foreign interference and intervention, and a very appropriate name for a vaccine. So they're using that. It's effective about 92.28% in three doses. So the big issue to summarise is that is COVID, to get that under control. The embargo has had some effect there, unfortunately, negative effect, of course, in that there's a shortage of needles and syringes and water purification equipment. Cuba's developed its own antigen diagnostic system and its own vaccines, but there's some ancillary equipment and supplies that they haven't been able to get. And we can talk about the embargo, but it's been hitting hard, particularly under Trump. And yeah. Biden's made no positive changes to reverse any of those horrible things either.
Yeah, so Ian, I think you've made a kind of like a very good kind of summary. And I guess your kind of answer has sort of opened up sort of two kind of different kind of aspects I kind of want to explore. And I guess the kind of first kind of aspect is, the second aspect I'll just say is I want to kind of explore kind of like a discussion with the kind of impacts of the trade embargo. But I think the first sort of question I'm sort of interested in asking is more one of the things that Cuba is kind of known for is its commitment to kind of global kind of solidarity. And in the, I guess, the context of this whole COVID-19 vaccine apartheid, i.e. the fact that most of the global north countries like the United States, Canada, Australia, the UK have kind of like bought up all the kind of best sort of vaccines. And of course, Cuba, being a global south country that, you know, doesn't have access to the kind of medical infrastructure that countries like the United States have. What has been, you know, Cuba's kind of role in terms of, you know, its distribution of the vaccine to, you know, its other neighbours, like including countries like Venezuela and so on, which have, you know, some of these countries and also other countries in Latin America who have had difficulties securing COVID-19 vaccines.
Yeah, well, you're quite right. I mean, look, since about 1961, Fidel Castro developed the Henry Reeve Brigade, which is an international brigade of Cuban doctors that go out to troubled parts of the world, maybe earthquake or famine or other disaster, human-made or natural. And it's been a remarkable thing. And coupled with the literacy campaign, which is even operated in Australia with Indigenous communities and in western parts of Sydney, where there are also Indigenous communities and poorer communities generally, it's an incredible thing. Only this past week, a large shipment of Cuban COVID-2 vaccines has been delivered to Venezuela. And also Mexico, Bolivia, Jamaica and Argentina have expressed interest as well. Cuban doctors have already been to places like Mexico and Venezuela, places that the United States in particular tends to ignore or treat contemptuously. And or very, very badly in the case of Venezuela. So you've got Cuban doctors going there as well. They have already been there helping out with COVID vaccinations and other healthcare problems. So, yeah, the Henry Reeve Brigade is just an incredible world wonder. It's been recently nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize for its humanitarian work over many, many decades. In terms of the vaccine itself, Cuba decided some time ago that with the embargo, it had to be self-sufficient in medical supplies as much as possible, and also in the production of vaccines and associated equipment. But it's had to get some supplies, including some American supplies, from third-party countries like Mexico. For example, if you want a Coca-Cola in Cuba, you can get it at an inflated price, but it has to go from the United States to Mexico and then to Cuba. America has been hitting hard third countries supplying Cuba, trading with Cuba, or in any way having dealings with Cuba. Even Australia has a small amount of trade with Cuba and has always had diplomatic relations with Cuba, never broke, as did the United States for many, many decades. But America is punishing other countries that have any sort of dealings with Cuba. Now, and some German companies, you might have heard of Merck, M-E-R-C-K, supplier of pharmaceutical products and equipment, they've got so scared of the United States' fear of reprisals that they've stopped supplying drugs and other medical equipment to Cuba. So the embargo is hitting hard and very perversely. But, yeah, America's done a great job in helping those countries that other countries, particularly the Western world, particularly the United States, ignores for political reasons.
Just to go into that later,
why the embargo persists, when so many Americans actually have been polled and don't want it to continue. But it's a narrow group of people in America, and we can talk about them, who keep the embargo alive. It's purely internal politics and a lot to do with Florida.
Yeah. Just to jump in there, Ian, good morning. This is Leo, one of the other co-presenters of the program today. Before we talk about the embargo, I just want to touch on a couple of points there around diplomatic relations. I think 2020, a lot of people that aren't necessarily in left-wing socialist circles experienced that sort of sense of solidarity with the Cuban government for the first time, as you say, with the doctors assisting overseas with the COVID-19 pandemic. This was especially notable in Italy during the height of their pandemic in early 2020. So I was just wondering, over these past, 12 to 18 months, how Cuba's international standing in the international community has evolved, and how, their diplomatic relations have evolved in this way, and to what extent this has created tensions with the US, which, no doubt would seek to monopolize this sort of feel-good factor in assistance and foreign aid, especially within Latin America.
Thank you. Look, the Cuban medical diplomacy and its literacy campaign that's been operating since 1961 throughout the world, first in Cuba in that year and throughout the world since, including Australia, have kept the reputation of Cuba extremely high. On the downside, you've got a fair bit of negative publicity recently, and I have to mention it. Some left-wingers would not want to mention it, but you've probably heard of a group called the Human Rights Watch. And it's been very concerned about Cuba in recent times in terms of what it describes as systemic human rights abuses against some independent artists, musicians and journalists, the San Isidora movement. Just to qualify that and modify any criticism of Cuba in relation to that and those people who have been critical internally of Cuba, the United States is very much supporting this group of independent artists, so-called independent artists and musicians and journalists, with money and is stirring them up with a view to creating as much negative publicity worldwide for Cuba as possible. But look, in the ultimate forum, one that matters, the United Nations, for the last 29 years and as recently as 1-2 weeks ago at the most, there has been a motion put before the General Assembly, which has been passed each of those 29 years, condemning the United States for its embargo. And in recent times, the only countries that have voted against this motion have been the United States and Israel. And that was the situation this year. Sometimes Australia has abstained on that vote, but this year it voted in favour of the motion to condemn the United States. So, and the United States keeps raising in the discussion in the United Nations General Assembly on this motion, oh, but what about the human rights abuses? And the United Nations has found that there are no appreciable systemic human rights abuses in Cuba that in any way that could possibly reasonably justify the continuance of this embargo. So I would say that on balance, the reputation of Cuba worldwide is deservedly very high indeed.
I mean, just to come in, I guess, with a comment there, just in general about kind of trade embargoes, I don't think, I mean, as a kind of socialist or someone on the left, I don't any kind of impose economic embargo on any country, I don't think can necessarily be justified in a sense that, that said, I mean, I do, in terms of like countries like Israel and so on, and countries that, run apartheid kind of states and so on. Obviously, there's a case to be made for some kind of, sanctions. But the practice of kind of economic kind of embargoes, like on say for like countries like Iran, you know, which are, you know, Iran does have a very repressive government, has never necessarily been kind of justified from any sort of socialist or progressive perspective, because the economic embargo doesn't necessarily impact, the economic embargoes have always disproportionately impacted on the working class people of those countries, the people who are not necessarily the ones who have influence over whatever repressive regime happens to kind of run those particular countries. And of course, the economic embargoes are never necessary when it comes as they're imposed by the US. You know, it's quite a lot, it's very hypocritical for them to go on about human rights, because actually the main reason is actually their imperialist interests, really. It's motivated by their own sort of economic kind of self-interest. But at the same time, you know, the US has lots of dealings with countries that commit human rights. And of course, let's not even get started on the United States' own problems with human rights, both in the country in terms of its treatment of African Americans, but also what it kind of does across the world in terms of its imperialist role in the world.
Yes. Look, one of the things, one Biden's spokesperson on Latin American affairs and Cuba in particular, Juan Gonzalez, has said that two things will govern U.S. foreign policy toward Cuba: human rights and democracy. And as you say, it's quite ironic, because in recent times, the United States has given $12 million to Colombia, and most of that has gone to Colombia's security forces that have been implicated in extrajudicial killings and opening fire on unarmed civilians. You've mentioned Israel with its apartheid system. And we've got Saudi Arabia, a most repressive absolute monarchy, it's quite happy to stoop to assassinations of journalists and others when it suits its purposes. It all gets down to geopolitical considerations. Now, Cuba was effectively a de facto American protectorate from 1902. Even before then, there was a U.S. military government in Cuba after Spanish independence from Spain. But until 1958, the end of 1958, you had effectively a de facto protectorate. And during that period, there were two brutal regimes, and there were several regimes, but the two main ones were Machado and Batista. Both of them were backed by the U.S. It was a gambling mecca. It was every conceivable vice was there, with the president getting anything from 2% to 10% of the takings from the casinos. This was a sort of country that a lot of ultra-right wing Cuban Americans would like to see back again. And they regarded it as a great democracy, but it wasn't. It was a failed democracy, and under all those regimes, and at times the most brutal military dictatorships. Even America cut Batista adrift towards the end in the late 50s. Unfortunately, if America can't control a country, it will try to destroy it or its people. And Cuba's of enormous geopolitical significance, its location, just a short distance from Miami. You know, we're talking about, 151 kilometres or so from Miami. It's very important geopolitically. That became clear in the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, which I'm old enough to remember quite well. It was a very scary time. And, America would still like to... It's incredible. I mean, look, Chinese-Americans don't determine U.S. policy towards China. Russian-Americans don't determine U.S. policy toward Russia, but a very small group of Cuban-Americans, ultra-right-wing, very capitalist Cubans in Miami, many of them who had ancestors that were croupiers in the casinos and involved in other unsavory activities, and in fairness, some of them were just small business people who had their properties nationalized, they're very bitter. And they determine U.S. policy toward Cuba. Because why is it that Chinese Americans don't do it, or Russian Americans, or French Americans? Because they can't swing an election, but Cuban Americans can. The key battleground state of Florida. So that's what keeps the embargo alive. It's not really America's hatred of communism. Yes, it hates communism. It equates socialism with communism, but it's not really that even. It still has diplomatic relations with Cuba. It was restored with embargo, but effectively the embassy in Havana is just non-functioning. And if Cubans want to, they have to go elsewhere. They can't do business through the Cuban embassy at the moment. Trump would say, I succeeded in changing Cuba to some extent, because the embargoes, he increased the embargoes on Cuba last year and the year before very, very severely. And Cuba's been forced to make a number of changes. And you asked earlier about some of the big developments in Cuba at the moment. And one of them is the growing private sector. Of a population of about 11.3 million, you've got almost half to three quarters of a million people who are now self-employed, and who can actually form companies. Before, they could be self-employed, but they couldn't actually sort of incorporate an entity, but they can now. And there's only a limited number of areas in which they can't work. So the growing private sector, free enterprise, they call it, is incredible. And even Raul Castro, when he was president, said that we've got a rather unjust inverted pyramid in this country. He said, we've got lawyers and doctors and engineers and scientists who are earning much, much less than tour guides and waiters and taxi drivers. Now, some socialists would say, well, what's wrong with that? But with it, you do get a brain drain, and Cuba lost a lot of its very well-qualified people. It's got some great universities over there, but they've been losing a lot of people to other countries in the region and to the United States, because they're just not getting, they can get better remuneration elsewhere. When I was over there, we were driven around much of the country by a taxi driver who used to teach. She was a professor of English at Pina del Rio University. But he gets more money driving a taxi, being self-employed. Mind you, that I've heard the same phenomenon over here.
Leah wanted to come in with a question.
Yeah, just really quickly on two sort of prongs. First of all, just if you could expand that discussion of the right-wing Cubans, especially, who often, I guess, homogenized as part of the Latin American community in the US and seen as, I guess, the spokespeople for that community. And if you could, perhaps touch on the impact that these diaspora communities have and this historical memory on influencing U.S. politics, and, you know, especially within the context of Florida, as you mentioned there. That would be my first question. Then the second one, whether there are any sort of developments with the Guantanamo Bay detention camp, and what likelihood, if any, there is to the Biden administration having any major sort of changes in policy in that area.
Yes, thank you. Look, starting with, first of all, the Cuban diaspora, largely in Florida, but it is spread to other parts of the world and United States. It's not a new development, and it didn't start on the 1st of January 1959. There'd been earlier revolutions before the 59 revolution. One of the most prominent ones was in 1933, when the then president Gerardo Machado was deposed in a coup that ultimately led to a sergeant's revolt and Fulgencio Batista coming to power, and he was in and out of power until 1959. But the first big diaspora of Cubans to the United States was in 1933. And that revolution that occurred in that year, Machado started out as quite a democratic and fair president, but ultimately became extremely brutal. And it was largely a communist coup that led him, that brought Batista into power. And although he was largely anti-communist, they had a strange coalition from time to time with between right and left, which you can get in some countries. And it seems so unlikely, but it does happen. But the first diaspora was around about 1933. Probably some Cubans went before then. But they have been characterized by basically being fairly well-to-do, normally self-employed, property owners who have been dispossessed, right-wing, very anti-socialist, very anti-communist, and that has continued to this day and all throughout the late 60s and 70s and beyond. There's been a continued diaspora of people trying to leave, and scarcely leaving Cuba. Now, I wouldn't say that all, it seems like around about 70% of Cuban Americans are fairly right-wing and would probably vote for someone like Trump, but not all of them are. Some of them are left-wing, and there's been demonstrations in recent times, counter-demonstrations in places like Miami last year during the presidential campaign, campaigning for the removal of the embargo. So, I mean, some of the more educated ones, the more university-educated ones that have gone to America, see how cruel the embargo is. Others, they just don't seem to care. They don't seem to realise that the embargo has not brought about regime change, but has basically just hurt ordinary Cubans very badly. Sorry, what was the second question? Was about
Just about Guantanamo Bay, whether there's any sort of developments.
Yeah, Guantanamo Bay was leased to America around about 1902 when Cuba supposedly, May 20, 1902, got independence. But it was a funny sort of independence because a long period of U.S. neo-colonization continued until the end of 58. The Cuban government was largely forced as part of an agreement of independence. I should go back a bit. The war between Cuba and Spain, there were actually three long liberation wars over a 30-year period. Between 1868 and 1898. The Americans came in at the end, Spanish-American War, ostensibly to help the Cubans fight the Spanish, but really they had an ulterior motive. As one U.S. president said, we saw that Cuba was ripe fruit, ripe for picking. So America went in there, and as part of an independence agreement, it secured a 200-year lease over Guantanamo Bay for a peppercorn rent. Barack Obama promised to close it down because it's the most inhumane place. I've been close to it, but I haven't actually been in the province of Guantanamo, but not to the prison. But he wasn't successful in getting it closed down. Trump had no intention of closing it down. And Biden, although he promised reforms, he was rather nonspecific about the reforms, but he did speak of the embargo serving no useful purpose. And he was concerned that Trump had stopped even remittances, money going from Cuban Americans, particularly in Florida, to relatives in Cuba, that had been cut down as well, cut out by Trump, which resulted in Western Union offices all over Cuba closing. Biden said, that's no good. I will restore remittances and loosen up travel restrictions on Americans getting to Cuba. But he didn't speak about Guantanamo Bay, to my knowledge, and certainly nothing has happened. It's not a big priority. The Democrats have been very much on the back foot with respect to Cuba. They have been the subject of a lot of criticism, and they're trying to you know, win back some of these Cuban Americans, or win them over, gain their trust. And so, sadly, in the short to medium term, I don't see any major changes in U.S. policy toward Cuba. And I think that Guantanamo Bay will continue to operate as a prison. It's not being much used at the moment, but it's still there. And when I was in Cuba, I bought a book by Fidel Castro, one of the last he wrote.
Hey, Ian, yes. Just apologies. I think you kind of ended on a good note kind of there. We'd love to hear your story. But unfortunately, we're running out of time, and we've got to get on
That's
to
fine.
The kind of next
no
interview.
No worries at all. I'm sorry about that.
But yeah, thank you very much, Ian. I think you've given a fantastic kind of overview of all the kind of recent kind of developments in Cuba. And yeah, we might have you on our program again, maybe in the future when more kind of developments happen, because we're definitely interested in covering Cuba more regularly for Green Left Radio.
Thank you. Happy to speak anytime. And thank you. Thank you both, Jacob and Liam. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Yep. You too, Ian.
Bye-bye. Bye.